is recorded in just four verses. Nonetheless, I think we're going to find it particularly important, especially in these last days. Again, we're going to see that common thread throughout all of the miracles of Elisha, with that theme of going from death to life, which again fits with the one whom he typified. Now, there's a lot of discussion about the chronology, because we go to chapter 5 and we read of Naaman and what happens with Gehazi at the end of that chapter. We go on, we get to chapter 8, we read of that Shunammite woman again. And I don't know that there is a satisfactory answer for what the chronology really is. So our focus needs to be on the events, not as much as what the chronology of it is. I don't think they're in chronological order, personally. All right, 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 38. And Elisha came again to Gilgal, and there was a dearth in the land. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him. And he said unto his servant, Set on a great pot, and seethe pottage for the sons of the prophets. And one went out into the field to gather herbs, and found a wild vine, and gathered thereof wild gourds, his lap full, and came and shredded them into the pot of pottage, for they knew them not. So they poured out for the men to eat. And it came to pass, as they were eating the pottage, that they cried out and said, O man of God, there is death in the pot. And they could not eat thereof. But he said, Then bring meal. And he cast it into the pot, and he said, Pour out for the people, that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. Elisha is now at Gilgal, and as we mentioned earlier, there are three Gilgals. This is where we believe Elisha is. There's another Gilgal further to the west, and there's another Gilgal we find below Jericho. If we look at the order of events in the travels of Elijah and Elisha, I think we find that it's more reasonable to look at this as the Gilgal that Elisha traveled to here in this instance. What's more important for us is the significance of what that name means, Gilgal. It means rolling away. And is important for us in terms of both what happens here and what's happening in Israel and what's happening in the Brotherhood today as well. Again, it was a time of famine. Yet we find these men listening to Elisha as he taught. To their credit, they sought the living food. We live in a time of great famine as well, a famine of the Word. Where is our focus? Is it to the satisfying of the flesh? It was common in those days for the students to sit at the feet of their teacher. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 10. Luke 10, verse 38. Now it came to pass as they went that they entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. Okay? Typical of a student of the Word in those days. Also in Acts 22. Verse 3. Paul relating his background. I am verily a man, which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous towards God, as ye all are this day. Okay, again, studied at the feet of Gamaliel. So we think of a gathering of these men here to listen to what Elisha has to teach them. And Elisha tells Gehazi to seethe pottage, or let's make a stew for the sons of the prophets. So Elisha is showing that his care was for their physical well-being as well as their spiritual well-being. So he commanded that food be prepared. Just Jesus, as Jesus taught us to give thanks for our daily bread. If we're going to serve Yahweh, then we must take care of the necessities of our bodies as well. So he's taking care of their physical needs. So all of them go out and gather what they could to put in this common pot. But this one man wanted to add to what was being prepared. We're not given much information about this man. It says he went out and found what he thought would be good to eat. Obviously, he didn't know what he was gathering. This is the colocynth plant, and Bullinger believes that this is what this man collected, because it's found in Israel. It's a member of the cucumber family. It's also a tremendous laxative. The dangerous thing here is if enough of it is consumed, it starts causing some really sharp pains and causes inflammation of the bowel, which can be deadly. So this man of his own volition grabs of what he sees as might satisfy the flesh and puts it in the pot. He used what was appealing to him. He didn't really have a knowledge of what he was doing. This is the lesson that we draw from this incident. It's typical of those who are not well grounded in the truth. And even with that statement, there are those who would apparently be well grounded who are not. They are unstable and unlearned. Let's turn over to, well, I got it here, 2 Peter 3. As also in all his epistles, speaking in them of Paul, these things, in which are some things hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable rest, as they do also other scriptures unto their own destruction. This man wasn't intentionally trying to bring death by putting these gourds in the pot. Just as there are those who don't intentionally, by bringing in erroneous doctrines, are trying to bring death amongst the brotherhood, but we must be aware of that. I'd like to read two quotes. One from a Christadelphian, the other from a non-denominational, non-profit, evangelic ministry active for 47 years, specializing in cost-effective evangelicalism and discipleship through mass media. One quote, from John's perspective, like salvation, eternal life is a present possession. It is a state the believer comes into rather than a physical reality. Eternal life is to be distinguished from immortality, in that eternal life simply means to live forever. The other quote, the newness of life which the believer derives is the very essence of salvation, and hence the life of glory or eternal life must also be theirs. It is the gift of God and Jesus Christ. The life of the faithful have here on earth is inseparably connected with eternal life beyond, the endless life of the future. Which is which? You don't have to answer that. Can we distinguish the difference in those quotes? There are those who are not intentionally trying to bring in erroneous ideas or false doctrine, but they think they're introducing something to help us better understand. Well, when we read words like that, what does that do for someone from the outside to say, what do you Christadelphians believe? How about a young person that might not accurately discern what's being written The intent of the person is not to try to lead astray, but also we must remember that our young people are there to learn and trying to absorb the things of the truth. What happens when they run into these conditions and don't read? I didn't give the complete quote, okay, to give credit to what was said here. I didn't give the complete quote, but somebody reads that much of it and they say, oh, okay, I see, when they're not studiously reading the whole intent of the message. The intent of that person is not to try and to bring in false doctrine, but brethren, there's death in that pot. We have to be careful. Fortunately, we have brothers and sisters who are well grounded in the truth that can raise the hand and say there's death in this pot. And when they do, what happens? What do you mean? You're unkind, you're uncaring. You know, we go back to the ecclesias in the Apocalypse. We read that within that ecclesia, there was commendation for those who contended for the faith. Commendation for those who contended for the faith, and condemnation for those who were in error. Yet we find there the two there trying to work together to come up with a solution here. You know, it is appropriate to stand up when we hear something that is error, but as Brother Williams said, you attack the doctrine and not the man. We've got to be very careful about that, because that has a great influence in our approach in dealing with error. If we attack the person, what kind of a mood does that set in everyone that hears that? Well, you just don't like them. You know, you attack the doctrine, not the man. A farmer, through the experience of his life, can tell you what's the difference between a cucumber and a colocynth. Fortunately for us, we have those brethren who understand the Word and can warn us of the dangers that can be innocently introduced but can poison the truth. These are likened to those who keep the Word. Let's turn over to 2 Timothy 2. Second Timothy 2, verse 15. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. And their words will eat as doth a canker, of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus, who concerning the truth have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some. No different in the days of Paul in our day. Okay? There seems to be a need in some instances to try and introduce something new rather than what Jeremiah recommends. Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways, and see and ask for the old paths, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But Israel, and apparently some today in the household, said, we will not walk therein. Now, what is, speaking of the old paths, Brother Williams, I think Brother Thomas is of the same mind here. Brother Williams wrote, if immortality is superior to eternal life, and the latter only means duration of life for 1,000 years, then we are asked to seek for a superior thing, only promised an inferior thing. Reason rejects this as absurd and concludes that since we are exhorted to seek for immortality and promised eternal life, that one must involve the other, or, in substance, both mean the same thing. And therefore, to receive eternal life promised is to receive immortality sought for. To cure the situation seems awful simple. Elisha says, bring meal. Bring meal. Is this some home remedy? I don't think so, because I don't think meal would have cured the poison that was in the pot. What was meal used for under the law? Let's turn over to Leviticus chapter 6. Leviticus 6, starting at verse 14. And this is the law of the meat offering, or the meal offering. The sons of Aaron shall offer it before the Lord, before the altar, and he shall take of it an handful of the flour of the meat offering, and of the oil thereof, and of all the frankincense which is upon the meat offering, and shall burn it upon the altar for a sweet savor, even the memorial of it unto the Lord. And the remainder thereof shall Aaron and his sons eat with unleavened bread, shall be eaten in the holy place, in the court of the tabernacle of the congregation, they shall eat it. The meal offering was an offering of the works of man's hands. And it must be careful what we offer. Not the poison of the apostasy or of worldly thoughts, but of a sincere, dedicated service to the fulfilling of Yahweh's will. There's an implication of what other items that made up this meal offering were as well. It says oil. Oil, what do we think of oil? We think of the Word. Frankincense, a sweet-smelling savor, acceptable prayer. Salt, preservative. No honey. Man likes sweetness. Gratification of the flesh is denied. And no leaven, nothing which corrupts. These all are things that direct us in our walk to keep on that straight way that we mentioned earlier. Things which aid the discerning mind to recognize that which leads to the way of life or that which leads to the way of death. So the lesson in this event is to teach us the value of spiritual discernment. This only comes from a spiritually trained mind, which by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil, as Paul describes in Hebrews 5. One who proves all things and holds fast to that which is good, rejecting that which doth eat like a canker. The fact was that they would have died except for the intervention of the man of God. This was the eighth miracle of Elisha, and eight speaks of immortality. Circumcision was performed on the eighth day, signifying the cutting off of the flesh. And this draws us to the eighth millennial day when all flesh will be cut off from the earth, and God will be all and in all. The final event of this chapter, the feeding of the 100, the bread of life. 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 32. And there came a man from Baal Shalisha, and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and full ears of corn in the husk thereof. And he said, give unto the people that they may eat. And his servitor said, what should I set this before 100 men? He said again, give to the people that they may eat. For thus saith Yahweh, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. So he set it before them, and they did eat, and left thereof according to the word of Yahweh. This is somewhat similar to the prior miracle, and probably is in the same location. Again, a life and death situation relieved. A man whose name is not given. A man from Baal Shalisha. As was typical in the days of the kings, they began renaming their cities and bringing them names of the false gods that they were worshiping. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 9. 1 Samuel 9, verse 4. And he, speaking of Saul, he passed through Mount Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they found them not, and he was looking for the asses. Then they passed through the land of Shalem, and were there, they were not there, and he passed through the land of Benjamin, and they were not found. But we see Shalisha mentioned here. We come down to the times of Elisha, and that's now Baal Shalisha. So the kings were now renaming the cities after their gods. And Shalisha means three ways. So this would be Lord of the Three Ways. Obviously, the thought here is this is a crossroad. Okay? A crossroad. The people were at a crossroad. Some were coming to Elisha. Some were not. Apparently, this area, which is northwest of Gilgal, Baal Shalisha is believed to be over in this area towards the coast. North and east of Gilgal. It was apparently a pretty fertile area because we're now in a time of famine, yet we see this man brings the abundance of the first fruits here, and he wanted to offer what was permitted under the law. Deuteronomy 26. Let's turn over there. Deuteronomy 26. Verse 1. And it shall be when thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and thou possessest it, and dwell therein, that thou shalt take of the first of all the fruits of the earth, which thou shalt bring of thy land, that the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt put it in a basket, and shalt go in unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name there. And thou shalt go unto the priest, and shall be in those days, and say unto him, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God, that I am come unto the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us. Well, where were the priests in that day? Could he go to Jerusalem? Nope. There were no priests of Yahweh to be found there. So, what does this man do? They say, well, forget that. I can't take it anywhere. He doesn't give up. And here's the lesson for us. Rather than give up, he takes it to the man of God. He looks for a place to share the abundance that he's been given. If he can't serve Yahweh in one fashion, what other ways can we serve him? Are we actively seeking for ways to serve him, or do we neglect it? Whatever prompted him, he sent, as we read in verse 42, 20 loaves of barley and full ears of corn in the husk thereof. There was some thought behind what this man brought. 20 barley loaves provided for the immediate need of the people. Also, this was dedicated bread, and therefore typical of the bread of life. The ears of corn and the husk provided for future needs. The offering looked forward to the promise of a full harvest. Now think about that. We're in a time of drought. Here this man knows conditions are not good. And what does he do with the abundance that's provided him? Does he hoard it? No. He shares it, and he shares it because of his faith that the full harvest would come, that deity would take care of his people. The offering looked forward to the promise of a full harvest. And again, this brings to mind Christ, the first fruits of the resurrection. Even though there was a famine in this land, this man of God recognized that he had been provided with sustenance, and in his gratitude would share it with those who were servants of Yahweh and demonstrate his faith that the full harvest would come. And here we begin to look at the parallel with Jesus and his ministry in the feeding of the 5,000. We're told here in the account in Elisha that he tells his servants to give unto the people that they may eat. In Matthew 14, we read, Christ tells his disciples, give ye them to eat. Gehazi states, what should I set before 100 men? Which showed his doubt and not his unquestioning obedience. We go back to the first event we talked about. And that widow showed unquestioning obedience to what she was told to do. Andrew in John 6 says, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. What are they among so many? The same problem. Showed doubt and not unquestioning obedience. Yet what do we find the solution is in the end? That there was enough for all, even with some to spare. Not only did Elisha and Jesus provide for the natural sustenance of the people, but their spiritual growth as well. It also demonstrates to us that the Lord would not forget His people. And you would wonder that the people at that time, seeing these events, would not question, where's Baal? Baal was a god of fertility. Where were the provisions of Baal for the people? How could they continue worshiping a god that won't answer because the god didn't exist? Yet they see this man who still serves Yahweh eating the abundance that was given to him in a time of drought. 2 points we learn. First, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. And second, it was a demonstration to God's people that they're not wholly forgotten in times of trouble. And we need to keep that in mind as we face the problems coming before us. This is the 9th miracle of Elisha. 9 speaks of finality or judgment. The numerical value of Dan, which means judgment, is 54, which is 9 times 6. In the 9th year of Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. Unless we partake of that bread of life, we won't have it. We won't have it. And think about what we heard in third period yesterday. You know, wake up. We must associate ourselves with the first fruits that we might be part of the first fruits of the resurrection. Again, common theme through these events we read of in the life of Elisha and the people, from death to life. And as you study the works of this man, keep that in mind, for there are many things that we can glean in the words of this prophet and in the events of his life. Thank you.